The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good morning. We've got to stop telling people that I'm speaking. It's obviously damaging the numbers. Well, folks, the topic is Christianity homophobic? For many people, it would be like asking, is the Pope a Catholic? I mean, it's just so obvious that Christianity is homophobic and that Christianity is one of the great causes and bulwarks of persecution and prejudice against the gay community. Of course, I've discovered as I've shared this topic with a few friends, some in the city and some not, that quite a few of them look a bit puzzled. And when I explain the background to it, they look a bit hurt because they're members of churches and they have no reason to think that they or the people who go to church have got some particular axe to grind with homosexual people. So it does seem to depend a lot on what part of the world that you live in and what part you hang around with. But we did think we needed to address the question directly, so today we must do it. And I need to speak with you about a number of things, and one is about a particular sin. It's a particularly disturbing and disgusting sin. It's clearly anti-Christian. It's vile. It dishonors God. It probably pleases the devil. It's the only sin that I've ever, in my limited experience, ever heard someone asked to leave the church about. Publicly it was said, if this is the sort of person you are, please leave St. Barnabas. One of the associate ministers at Barney's did this when I was rector there with my blessing. And it is, of course, the terrible sin, although I have to use an unusual word for it, it's the serious sin of homophobia, using it in its popular use. If you use homophobia in the way that it's often used, not in a sort of technical, sort of lexical way of saying it's the fear of homosexuals, but in the way that it's normally used, which is it's a sort of dislike, hatred, hostility towards homosexual people. If there's any of that sort of treatment or attitude towards gay people, that really has no place amongst the redeemed sinners who call themselves Christians. So we'll look at that as we go through today and next week as well. But why would anyone accuse Christians of being homophobic? Well, I want to suggest that there are two reasons, and one of them I have connected here to a YouTube so we can listen to a bit of preaching as it should be done. I remember when I was at Shaw School, I was chatting with a couple of staff, quite educated, cultured staff, and they were talking about this church that pickets various things with these large signs. It says things like this, God hates fags. And I said, rubbish. It's inconceivable that there would be a group of Christians who would walk around with huge posters like that. And they said, this is in the 1990s. So they said, go and just type in God hates fags or God hates faggots and see what comes up. So I type it in, and it's actually the URL of this particular church in the United States of America. It's called the Westboro Baptist Church, and it gets covered in the Australian media two or three times a year. So for my group of old friends from school, most of whom are strongly not Christian, I worked out that every second time we meet, they will come up. And they'll come up as if they're kind of representative of a mainline view within Christianity. So, you know, there's Roman Catholics, there's Anglicans, there's Westboro Baptists, there's, you know, Orthodox. It's like that. And I think the media keep running it as if this is a mainline view. The church itself is really one man, Fred Phelps, and his children, and people who've married into it, and their grandchildren. And I thought just so you get a feel for the what does look like the extreme, I don't want to give it some, you know, I'm thinking of it as psychopath, but it mightn't be the word. Everything this guy has seems to be about hate. So he's got other websites. There's God Hates Fags. There's God Hates Jews. There's God Hates Catholics. There's Priests Rape Boys, as his site may say they regularly attack the American flag. They're an interesting group. Here's what he thinks of Australians. This is from their website. God hates Australians. I mean, it's just... At one level, I saw some of you smile, and it is hard. There is something almost send-up comical about it. God hates Australia. The sodom. But this gets played to my friends in Australia. I was talking to an American guy the other day, an educated world traveller. He's never heard of them. So apparently, if you're more able to hear about the Westboro Baptist Church in Australia than you are in much America. But those sorts of really fringe groups, I mean, the poor Baptists, they have disowned these guys 1,000 times. But unfortunately, they didn't have a copyright on the name Baptist in a way that could shut them down with good lawyers, so they're able to use it. But it's one family, basically. And yet that gets fed into our world. And so that seemed to be a not insignificant part of the Christian response. Therefore, I'm saying that there is a reason for people to think that we are homophobic, those of us who are Christians. The other reason, I think, and a very different reason, is, and we've chatted about this in another context, is what I would describe as the mutation of the word tolerance. That is, in this political struggle that's been going on for about 30 years in Australia and other countries, the word homophobia is used not just for people who are frightened of gays. The word was made up around about 1960. It's just a direct parallel from xenophobia, irrational fears. So homophobia. But that's not really, I think, what the word normally means. It really should be related to things like misanthrope or misogynist, with the idea of someone who hates something. That's the concern. But the concern is not that you're frightened of something. If you're frightened of something, that's hardly a pejorative. A person who's frightened of something... instruction, hatred of homosexuals is the issue. And that's normally how it's used. Often it will be, that word will be used, and then the phrase that will go in the same paragraph will be things like hate speech and things like that. So, but, you know, if you try to make a word up from misan homosexual, it doesn't kind of work. I tried. Whereas homophobia sounds good. But the problem is, it doesn't mean what either it means in terms of the origins of the word. It means you hate and oppose and are vicious towards and wish ill towards individual gays in the gay community. So in the last couple of decades, some of you will have found yourself in this situation where there are only two positions on the question of homosexual people and friends and neighbours, etc. That is, you either can put your hand on your heart and say, I am as happy with people being homosexual as with them being heterosexual. There is no problem with being gay except the fact that other people say there's a problem with being gay. If you could just stop homophobia, homosexuality would be fine. Every single psychological problem that the gay community has, and they do have marked much higher areas of addictions to drugs, multiple drugs, much higher levels of depression and things like that. That's all because of what people like me do to them. So that I am the problem for the gay community. So that there's this tendency to say you're either absolutely pro it, or you're a bastard, really. You're a homophobe. You're full of hate speak, no matter how nicely you put it. And I remember a young man who I met in my time at Shaw and continued a friendship with him afterwards, a gay guy. I really wish I'd raised it with him earlier because he had... my understanding of one of the great causes of homosexuality had all treated him and didn't treat him. But this guy is a very thoughtful guy, very impressive human being in so many ways. But he said, the problem with you, Ian, is I know you don't hate us, and I know you speak to defend us, etc. But he said, you give a certain credibility and justification for those who do just hate us and vicious, you know, vicious towards us. People like you, he says. So there's a tendency to say that you're one or the other. Now, I think many of you would think, well, I'm neither. I neither think it's a perfectly that two men having sex together or two women having sex together is good and right and natural even, nor do I wish them ill, nor do I, you know, stay up late at night planning ways to oppose them and make their life misery. So I think the other reason why Christianity is accused of being homophobic. The first one was that because there are some homophobes, you know, and disgusting people. Not many in my experience, but some. But secondly, because if you're not pro-gay, you're a rat. You're a dinosaur. You've got issues, etc., etc. You need to be shut down. And you'll see this again and again. I think without getting into the Bob Catter ads in Queensland, I've watched the ads. But really the interesting thing with the Bob Catter thing is the response to it. I think that's what's often interesting. But some of you may have read about this thing that happened in the States in the last couple of weeks. If you haven't, I'll tell you. Because it's symptomatic, I think, of what's happening. Kirk Cameron is a well-known Christian actor in America. He's part of this film that's come out that's been blowing everyone away. It was made on a shoestring, but it's made over $30 million in the first few weeks. It's kind of surprised Hollywood. It's a Christian-themed movie, but he's a well-known Christian actor. And he was invited onto the Piers Morgan Tonight Show and was asked about the movie, but was asked, as Christians almost always are now, his attitude to gay marriage, to homosexuality, of course, which is completely irrelevant to the interview. But that's what normally happens. Well, he gave, I have watched it a number of times, he gave what was a fairly calm, gentle response, saying what any classical Christian from almost any Christian tradition would have to say, which is, no, I don't actually think homosexual marriage is a good idea, and nor do I think people having sex with people of the same sex is what God has in mind. Well, he was sort of slightly patronizing the interview, but as you could expect, the viciousness that broke out afterward is the interesting thing. Things like this, these are some of the nicer ones made by other celebrities. He was described by one person as the a-hole of the week. Another person said, rock and roll sort of celebrity said, Kirk Cameron is an accomplice to murder with his hate speech. So I went back and watched, I think, there's nothing hateful, I don't think, about it, unless you take the view that if you disagree with me on an important issue, you must hate me, which is the way it seems to work. Anyhow, to his credit, he came out with a response afterwards. He said, in a recent interview about my film Monumental, I was asked to share my views on homosexuality, gay marriage and abortion. I spoke as honestly as I could, but some people believe my responses were not loving towards those in the gay community. This is not true. I can assuredly say that it's my life mission to love all people. I believe that freedom of speech and freedom of religion go hand in hand in America. I should be able to express moral views on social issues, especially those that have been the underpinning of Western civilization for 2,000 years, without being slandered, accused of hate speech, and told that from those who preach tolerance, that I need to either bend my beliefs to their moral standards or be silent when I'm in the public square. These are complicated matters. That is why I believe we need to learn how to debate these things with greater love and respect. Now, that's just one of many cases where someone is asked. He did not bring it up. He did not go to the television to preach it. But he was exposed. I'm sure Piers Morgan knew exactly what his view was. But he asks it, and then he gets smashed. And what that does is it says to anyone who's got any sensitivity, don't you dare speak. Some years ago, you might remember Professor Blaney, the Australian historian, one of our two or three most eminent historians, made a comment about the racial mix of Australia. And I read what he said, and he was just saying, we need to have a discussion. This needs to be not decided by various politicians and public servants, but Australia needs to be involved in the discussion of the sort of population mix we're going to have. You may remember what happened. He was smashed in the media as a racist and all this sort of stuff, which... And what's the end result? The only person who speaks about that is someone like Hanson. Because everyone who's got any sensitivity and any sense of being a decent person who's not a racist won't say it, because if you speak up, then in the end it's left to someone like Pauline Hanson. I'm not going to be hard on the woman. I like redheads myself, but I think, because everyone says don't talk. This is what I think is happening. So I think, why are Christians pictured as homophobic? Because tolerance has been mutated. The tolerance doesn't mean anything like tolerance now. Tolerance means you must agree with me. So I remember there were two boys I was talking with at Shaw when I was there, discussing some of the issues of homosexuality. And there was another teacher there, a very fine teacher. And she said, well, the difference between me and Mr. Powell is I'm more tolerant than Mr. Powell. Now, she didn't mean it rudely. So I went back and said to her, I said, look, I won't mention her name. Look, you're not more tolerant about homosexuality than I am. You have no tolerance to homosexuality because you don't think it's wrong. You're not in tolerance zone. I don't tolerate gelato. I tolerate cream when it's mixed up with pavlova. I hate cream. It makes me want to vomit. But I'm nice about cream when it's on the table. So tolerance is what you do when you've got someone you don't agree with. To say that tolerance means you agree with someone is just it's a very step backwards in our culture. And that's Christians are seen as homophobes, because most Christians feel if two men having sex together is okay with God. So they're the two reasons. Well, let's have a look very briefly. We'll look next week more thoroughly at what the Bible says about homosexuality and ways to take it seriously. But I suppose just to very briefly address the question, well, if it's true that Christianity has got this unacceptable position, which can be said uncarefully and can be said carelessly, why is it? Is it from the very source of the river, or is it some tributary that's come in that's polluted the river? Is it, if you like, is it nature or nurture? Has Christianity, has Jesus, has the Bible, is it fundamentally homophobic, in the usual use of the word that I disagree with, or is it something else? So what does the Bible say about this? Is Christianity at its roots homophobic? Well, firstly and briefly, the Bible doesn't say much about homosexuality, as you probably know. It's hardly obsessed with the topic. It's always odd when our culture says, you Christians are obsessed with sex. I mean, for our culture to say of anybody else you're obsessed with sex is very rich, I think. What happens is we get asked that, we get asked an opinion. We give an opinion, then we get punished. Now, 66 books in the Bible. There are how many times is homosexuality mentioned? 66 books. It's mentioned 5 times. And in none of the 5 times is it the major topic. It's touched on amongst a number of other things. That's all it ever is. So 8 verses, I've worked, it's about 8 or 9 verses out of 31,000. You can do the maths. I'm just saying that to draw attention. Like, this is hardly a major issue in the Bible. Now, for people like me and sort of many Christians, one mention is worth taking note of. Do you know what I mean? But it's just worth saying it's hardly a big issue in the Bible. There is much, 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 much more said about injustice in the courts. There's whole sections about that, and the perverting the course of justice. So there's whole diatribes against people who do that. There's much more said about adultery. I mean, there's whole stories about the vileness of adultery. Does that mean the Bible should be described as heterophobic? Because on the free expression of heterosexual sex? I wouldn't have thought so. It's not saying ever anything like heterosexual sex, homosexual sex. What it says is, as the first verse you've got there in Genesis from Matthew 19, which we looked at last week briefly, and we'll come back to in 2 more weeks again, sorry, is acts of deep sexual contact between people that is not in the context of marriage, that is a permanent male-female relationship, is not the way God has designed it. And all sorts of things like sex with animals and other things like that are just mentioned as passing examples of sexual activity outside. No matter how much I say I love someone, if I'm not married, I'm not married. And marriage in the sense that... Let's have a look at one other important verse I think that people will bring up, both Christians and the opponents of Christianity. What about Sodom? Don't the city because of homosexuality? And I would think that's an understandable but fairly reading of the text. There is no doubt just destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Men of Sodom seek to homosexually rape the messengers from God. Now this breaks any number of codes in the think that Islam's got the wonderful thing about hospitality way beyond the birth of Muhammad, beyond the that you must treat with great care, and to abuse is a particularly vile thing because there's so for a group of men to seek sexually rape a man who's a traveler. Here's what Ezekiel says when the prophet speaks on behalf of God, explaining why Sodom gets destroyed. Ezekiel 16:49. Now this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. God is speaking to the city of Samaria, about to destroy after hundreds and hundreds of years of warning. This was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride, plenty of food, comfortable security, but they did not care for the poor and needy. Sound like any city you know? Right? This was the sin of Sodom. Not that they attempted to rape these guys. They were proud, plenty of food, comfortable security, but did not care for the poor and needy. That's why God says that city is going to be wiped out. Right? It's not about sodomy. It's a shame that that things have naturally blurred in our mind because we've named sin. Aware that time is rushing on and we do have a week. Let me just draw your attention to the two main passages we've got in front of you. You heard John 8 read. It is an extraordinary passage, John 8. It's a shame that we sort of hear it and go into a sort of overdrive or sort of a neutral automatic pilot. Luke 18 is critical. Look at verse 9, the first verse. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. And that's the famous parable of the two men who go to pray. One, the very, very good, and one, this disgracefully bad. It's just worth noting this description. This is kind of a description who are furthest away from any understanding of the heart of Christianity. They're described in verse 9. Confident of their own righteousness, look down on everyone else. Now, we've chatted about this in the past, but if you are the sort of person who thinks, I am a terribly good person, the world would be a lot better if there were more people like me. I've actually had members of my extended family say that to me. Bizarre, because, I mean, everyone in the room is going, just because this guy was nothing but damage in his family, but completely oblivious. But this combination of confident of our own, looking down on others. Jesus, that sort of person knows nothing. Any recognized in the New Testament, if you think that you're ever so terribly good and all these other people are ever so terribly wicked. Although, as I've shared with you in the past, I'm often told by friends of mine who are atheists or people who I meet how good they are. As if I could care less. You know, I'm not asking, are you a good person? You know? Please let me run this little goodness question with you. But there's a lot of chatter about how good people are. Anyone who's a Christian who meets a gay person and has the view, oh, I'm so much better than you, you vile piece of work. They really are 1,000 light years from the Spirit of Jesus. That's the key vice, according to Jesus, is pride, arrogance. And then in John 8, we have this extraordinary story. It floats around this story between Gospel and John's Gospel. It's very clearly an early story about Jesus. It's got little intriguing things. It's the only reference to Jesus' writing. It's got that wonderful statement that gets used and misused, let him who is without sin cast the first stone. That gets used at me quite often by a particular friend who hates what I believe. But you know the story. This woman is dragged out, caught in the very act of adultery. But somehow or other, she seems to not have an accomplice. The man is not there. I mean, just it is disgraceful sexism. Because it's hard to do adultery on your own. You can do other sins on your own, but it's a team sport. But the woman gets dragged out in this disgraceful sexism. She's just used as an object to try and nail Jesus. You know that it's, verse 11. Jesus says to her, "Where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you." At that point, Jesus should be quiet. At that point, our society goes, "Good on you, Jesus. You affirm the adulteress." I mean, she was probably in a loveless marriage. The guy's wife probably didn't understand him. You know, love, find it wherever you can, go for it. You know, "Neither do I condemn you," Jesus says. Then he blots his copybook hopelessly. "Go now and leave your life of sin." Can we just talk about this relationship you're having? Because it might be okay. If you really love her and if you didn't mean to do any harm. No, you're not interested. That's not the Bible. The Bible's concern is what you do with your body. not sort of ephemeral questions of how you feel and how you think they feel. So he does not condemn her, but neither does he condone what she's done. The Christians are always doing in all sorts of things. God loves us just as we are, but he loves us far too much to leave us as we are. Whether it's adultery, homosexual sex, any other sort of sex, but calls us also to a new life. Finish on by telling you the story where I heard people ask to leave church. It was at St. Barnabas Broadway. We'd had a number of people who'd been converted out of quite very overt homosexual lifestyle. And it was interesting, one of the guys was interviewed telling his story to the church. He said, you know, the community I was in, we hated St. Barnabas Broadway. He said, we hated Hillsong and we hated Barney's Broadway. And everyone, why? We're such nice people. He said, because we know what you stand for. And he said, we didn't like you. He had a very gentle manner that could be mistaken as sort of homosexual, which is silly. He turned around and said to one of the young guys just who sat next to him in the evening service, "Hi, my name's," and the guy said, "I've got a girlfriend," you know. And this poor guy was just he was so hurt. It was so horrible. And then we had another guy who'd come to us from a church which had told him that his same-sex attraction was sin, which is complete rubbish. That's so stupid. So we just thought we need to nip this in the bud. We don't know, you know. So Mike got up and said, I can't remember exactly, but he said, "Look," he said, "if you're not a Christian, if you're here as a homosexual," and we had at one stage a couple of couples coming with their partners, very obviously gay. In fact, they're all over each other in a way that if they were heterosexual, we said cut it out. But they were, but we thought, well, we don't want to be misunderstood. But if you're homosexual and you're looking at Christianity, we're so glad you're here. You're absolutely welcome. This is what this church exists for. He said, if you're a Christian and you know that your attraction is to people of the same sex and you're working on that, trying to trust God, you are absolutely welcome. And if you make mistakes at times and sin in that area, you are absolutely welcome. But he said, if you see yourself and feel that you can be harsh to despise people who are gay, whether they're Christian or not, he said, Mike said, please leave the church immediately. He said, either repent or get out. This is, you know, we do not want people like you in the church. It's unchristian. Go and find a community like that. And it was quite shocking, but I thought it was quite right. I don't think Christianity is homophobic at all, but I understand why it is seen that way, particularly with the mutated view of tolerance. I will now shut up, see if we've got time for questions. Okay, thanks. How long have we got here? Now, here's an important question. The real debate seems to be between those that argue that homosexuality is a learnt behaviour, nurture, and those that say it's genetic, nature. If it is genetic, how can someone deny their nature? Firstly, can I say that if people study the literature now, no scientists are arguing that it's genetic. There was an argument in the early 90s that it was, and even the Sydney Morning Herald, which is entirely pro-gay, much as I like the Herald, I did laugh out loud when their ad said, "Without a gender." You remember those TV ads a while ago? "Without a gender." I guffawed. I hadn't had such a good belly laugh in ages. But it has very strong agendas. It's entirely pro-gay, and it's got every right to be. They can do whatever they like, I guess. But it is simply not. But it is. I mean, there are what they call neurobiological, so that gay men have a preponderance of Rheus negative blood types. I mean, there are certain clusters of than not, but an awful lot of the stuff about the gene stuff is just it's not taken seriously by any in the field. And frankly, so what if it is genetic in terms of deciding right and wrong? When I was at Shaw, we only had one boy die in my 9 years there, which was because the headmaster used to pray for them, I think. But he died of cystic fibrosis. That's genetic. That something is genetic does not mean it is good. But it does say this, if it is genetic, and I think for many people it is, you know, there's certain biological things that predispose it. It means we need to be deeply empathetical. Do you know what I mean? I think we've got to say this. You're not asking, I still don't like I don't like the position that the Bible puts me in this one, because you are asking people to change and to challenge the deepest areas of their sense of who they are. So that would be my answer. If it's genetic, how can someone deny their nature? Well, as I said, there are actually biological clusters, this neurobiological things, which are tied up with things that our society ain't going to say are okay. So that we may have physical leanings in an area does not determine the right or wrongness. It does get used, though, in debate. Okay? But we'll move on. The Bible mentions of homosexuality. Don't these include death? Admittedly, also for adultery. This question's right. In the two times it's mentioned in the Old Testament, it is in the category of sins that can be executed for, put to death for. And you need to ask your Jewish friends about how they feel about that. Because what happens in the New Testament, some Christians are stupid, and... Oh, I shouldn't say that, should I? No, okay, I've got stupid members of my earthly family. Some Christians are unwise in the way that they use the Old Testament. The Old Testament law is the Old Testament law. It's for those who were brought out of the land of Egypt. It's like the law of England. It's very important and informative as we interpret our law, but it's not the New Testament law. It's not the law Christians are under. So I would never use the verses in Leviticus because I just think they're not relevant to where we're living. And in that, the Old Testament law, there's quite a number of things for which the death penalty is appropriate. The God's refusal to allow homosexual sex as part of his good order of creation, his refusal to give it the thumbs up, is because he's got one place where he gives it the thumbs up, Genesis 2, Jesus' great verse where he goes back to Genesis 2 where sex belongs. But what doesn't come through is the punishments at all. And that's part of what's happening in John 8. Does Jesus agree with the Old Testament that adulteries are not negotiable? Absolutely. But does the Old Testament punishment come through? No. And it's refracted into the New Testament. It doesn't. We can talk about that later. And the last question we'll have time for, I think, unfortunately, is my homosexual colleague, who might come next week, has been in the same relation for 2 decades. If he was to convert to Christianity, should the relationship cease? Or would he be like a spouse who became a Christian who was told not automatically to leave the marriage and the non-Christian spouse? That's a really good question and a hard question. Off the top of my head, I think I would say that, as has happened to a number of my friends in heterosexual relationships that were not right, they had to stop having any sexual contact immediately. But they could perhaps continue to live together. I think the idea of people who are not married teaming up to buy a house and to enjoy each other's friendship is a wise idea. Will it be misunderstood as homosexual? Perhaps. But I think in the end, I'm heterosexual, for which I take no credit, in the same way as my friends who are gay should not at all be condemned, because that I didn't choose to be heterosexual, they didn't choose to be homosexual. We've got to be really careful how we speak about this, although some gays do choose to be gay, which I would never have said a couple of years ago. We might come back to it. The lady from Sex and the City, Cynthia Nixon, I think her name is, has come out, you know, has got a gay partner, and she said, I love men, I love women, I think women are better. And who smashed her? The gay community smashed her in America. She was savaged because, you know, making out as if there was some sort of choice. You're not allowed to say that. This is the strange thing in our community, is the loss of freedom of speech in this area, that there are certain orthodoxies that if you don't mouth them, you're in trouble. My view would be, yes, if the person became Christian, any sex outside of the Genesis 2 model is not what God has said. The companionship and the deep love they have for each other as people, perfectly fine. The Bible's concerned about what you do with your body, because ultimately what you do with your body is inseparable to things that happen in the soul as well. How's that for a short answer to a complex question? This book is brilliant, and if you're a Christian or not a Christian, I want to urge you to read it. I just think, I know some of the people whose stories are here, and they're truthful, and they will shock people, no matter what position you take. What some of you were, it's just a very helpful book written in most.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.